broadcasting from Melbourne, Victoria. You're listening to the Investor Exchange. Tune in each week and listen to the guys from United Global Capital discuss the topics that matter the most to your finances. Each episode will help you separate the noise from what really matters, giving you timely and actionable information you can use. We'll cover areas related to financial markets, property, politics, personal finance, and the economy. Now, here's your host, Stephanie Sumner.
And a very good morning to our listeners and to the guys in the studio here with me. Good morning, guys.
Good morning.
Morning, Steph.
Good morning.
Welcome back.
Very exciting. It's a long weekend this weekend.
Woohoo.
Happy travel plans, day. Guys? Anyone going anywhere special?
Louis going to Brisbane?
The Brisbane Rangers. It's not quite Brisbane. A little camping trip. And then actually there's a wedding that I'm going to on Australia Day on the Sunday.
Very good.
Very nice.
Yep.
Be hard to get back into work.
Yeah, it will. Yeah, lovely. It's actually not a wedding of anyone I know. I'm playing in the band.
Right.
Saxophone. Okay.
Yep, playing on saxophone.
Wedding crusher.
Do you get free drinks with that?
I do get free drinks with that. Yeah. It's actually one of the conditions on my contract.
Nice.
Actually, do you write your own contract?
Ron Burgundy and the, what is it, the jazz flute?
Oh, yeah, that's
right. Is that what you're playing?
He plays the saxophone too.
He does play the saxophone. Yeah. He's kind of a big deal.
So am I.
And Brady, are you going away anywhere or just taking it easy this week?
Yeah, taking it easy. Probably a day trip. If the weather's good, I'll probably head somewhere for the day, but no overnight plans.
Yeah, good one. And Joel, I think we're actually heading up to...
We're heading up to the Gold Coast. Yep. My mum and stepfather have just finished a renovation on a new property they've bought up there. They're hoping to spend their time half between Melbourne and half between Queensland.
That works. Wow.
Sounds like a pretty good retirement plan, if you ask me.
Well, that's how I'm spending next week.
It is. Yes.
So, my travel plans start on Tuesday, heading up to the Gold Coast, work-related, though.
Yes.
To see Joel, is it?
That's part of it.
Yeah.
that just happens to coincide, amongst other people. Yes.
It's always a problem trying to get in contact with him when you're together.
Noted. My phone will be off at night.
I think I've been on the receiving end of trying to get through to Joel and not being able to have that phone picked up. But anyway.
Whoopsie. Okay. This is awkward.
Now, moving right along, we're talking about property prices, not just specifically in the Gold Coast, but the average median house price in Melbourne specifically is now over $850,000, isn't it? So
a new high.
Yeah.
A new high. Excuse me. Wow.
Why don't you talk about that? What does it mean, guys? What should we be looking for with properties going forward? What does this new high mean? Because it's not just Melbourne, is it? It's Sydney as well.
Well, it's not quite new highs, but obviously the turnaround has happened. We've spoken about that, and property prices are increasing. Well, the medians, but the average sales are increasing. So it shows that the market's positive, but we're entering into uncharted territories in a number of ways with the property market. So obviously, every time we get a higher median, well, that's uncharted territory where prices have never been this high before. We're in an environment where interest rates have been at the lowest they've ever been for the longest period they've ever been this low. Yet we're still ranked on world terms as having some of the most unaffordable property on the planet.
What? How does this happen? I'm just waiting for this crash. Like, it's been years of this. How do we keep sustaining this?
I think there's one driving factor behind all of this. When you blend all this together, what is the, if you could put your finger on one reason, I think Australia is such a great place to live and people still want to come here. So the demand is still so great. It can be the only reason when you drive at all.
It's the population growth. The demand, everyone needs somewhere to live. And then the supply side is not just open slather. People come here because they want to live here, but they don't want to live anywhere in Australia. And even though Australia is a big country, the places that are actually inhabitable is not a huge area.
It's not like the US where you can set up houses all through the Midwest and
That's right.
But I've got to ask, so Chinese buyers were stopped from investing as much in the Australian market not that long ago. Where is the other money coming from? Because there's obviously a big process to live in Australia. Where are these investors coming from, and where is the money coming from? Because I would have thought that there's a lot of people coming from other countries that don't have as much money. where is all this money?
Well, if I may, I think the real estate market is one beneficiary of having a very stable economy for the best part of almost 30 years now. I mean, we haven't seen a recession since 1991. So, you know, we're pushing up to 29 years since the last time we had a recession. So, what that's saying is that even though you might come to Australia with very little if you're an immigrant from a low socioeconomic country, you've got a good chance of finding a good paying job, being able to afford a decent standard of living and being able to get access to credit, which is cheap and affordable and doesn't discriminate between who can get it and who can't. And you can set yourself up to be in a position to buy your own property. And we're seeing the benefit of that. And that's why we haven't had any real significant, you know, cataclysmic events in the real estate market because we haven't had any real cataclysmic events in the broader economy.
But is it a bubble?
No, I can't see how it could be a bubble because there's too much underlying strength in our economy that the market could collapse. People can still service their mortgages. I mean, we'd have to have a big shitstorm for enough people to not be able to pay their mortgages and be foreclosed.
I agree with that.
Strong at the moment.
It is, but the interest rates are low and unemployment's relatively low.
I think
what we're probably going to see a little bit more of, though, is more volatility in real estate prices over the next few years than what we've probably seen for the last 30. Look, you can go around to a whole lot of places and see that even though real estate markets have been expensive across the globe, Singapore, these real estate markets have been expensive and been expensive for decades, okay? And everyone's saying, you know, unaffordability, geez, these could be a real estate bubble in those areas. And the reality is you get a bit of a correction. I mean, even New York, which was one of the most expensive real estate markets in the world, and Hong Kong, and, you know, where all of these financial issues took place, their real estate markets held up a hell of a lot better than most of the other peripheral real estate markets. Yep. So, and why is that? Because it's desirable, strong incomes, you know, you've got strong demand for people to want to move in and live in. So, it has gone to support ever higher real estate prices even in those already very, very expensive markets. And so, what that shows is that this can go on for a very long time. However, we are probably going to see, like we saw most recently in the last 18 months, more volatility when things get a little bit dodgy. So, we're going to be – because affordability is at its peak and because debt levels are – quite high levels, what you're going to see is that rather than having an 8-10% correction in real estate prices, you're going to get a 15% correction like what we just saw. So, the most recent real estate correction was probably the most deepest that we've had in the last 50 years or so. But it came and it went and it-
The recovery is quite quick.
Recovery was quite quick,
Can I ask as well, I mean, last podcast we spoke about units being, you know, another, you know, thing that people would start investing in because it's just cheaper for them to be able to afford something like that. But what about properties and buying your dream home? Is there less supply out there? Because we had a friend that's trying to buy in a good suburb of Brisbane, and he's just saying that there's just no supply on the market for where he actually wants to live, and he just can't enter into that market at all in the price and suburb that he's looking for.
Great point, because that drives why we choose certain properties as better for investment than that. Because there's limited supply, they're probably willing to increase their budget. So, if you own the type of property that person's talking about, that's in demand. That's not apartments. It's not small townhouses.
But if people stop moving, does that do anything to the market? Because people are sitting on these properties for a lot longer.
It drives the prices of those particular properties up.
But people just, will they be giving up and just going, well, look, I may as well just take a unit because it's just an easier thing for me to
Well, they'll make a judgment call as to whether, you know, if they really want to own their own home, if that's what they're looking for, they'll make a judgment call to compromise in some way. They'll either overpay or not overpay, but increase their budget to be able to get whatever is on the market, because there's always something on the market that they'd love. It's just whether they can afford it. Or they'll compromise in either location or size and style of dwelling. They'll make a compensation somewhere.
And I think with some of that affordability, with some of the affordability issues that are now starting to rear their head again, you're actually starting to see the apartment market, particularly in Melbourne, is starting to respond. So, I've got a little stat here that basically suggested that Melbourne units have now reached a new all-time median high of $550,000 after surging 12.2% over the last 12 months. to the end of December. So, you know, as the prices have started to recover, people are starting to realize that, hey, you know.
I think there's more of a story behind that unit price that we should clarify too. And this is just from my understanding, talking with people that are buying and selling properties and looking at how we got here. And Steph, you asked a question before about, you know, where have the investors gone? You know, how are there still so many people able to buy property?
Yep.
If you look at the boom we had, which was sort of 2013 to 17, and how a lot of it was driven by offshore investment, and the supply was mainly apartments.
Yeah.
You know, the investor range was that $400,000 to $600,000 price point, which was mainly apartments in the close to the CBDs of Melbourne, Sydney, Brisbane, the majority of that.
Yeah.
Then as the Chinese were unable to get the money out, the demand sort of dropped. There was a bit of an oversupply for a while in those apartments. But also, especially in Melbourne, they introduced what they called the BADS, which was the, can't remember what the acronym stands for, but it's basically better apartment design, because there was a lot of crappy apartments being built at that $350,000 to $500,000 price point that had limited natural light, awkward sized rooms, just not very livable, but they were still being sold because a lot of it was offshore and people weren't really caring. They just wanted an apartment in the Melbourne region. So what Joel just mentioned about apartments reaching new high, I think the reason behind that is that the majority of apartments that are hitting the market now are probably 20 to 30% bigger than they were 3 and 4 years ago. So therefore, the prices probably aren't on a square meter rate that much higher, but they're bigger.
Yeah.
So therefore, the median has to be growing.
I have to say though, in the CBD at the moment, they're building these apartment blocks that are just about touching each other's.
Yeah,
just reach out and touch the other balcony.
So a lot of that would have been planning decisions that were made back in 2013, 14, 15 with Matthew Guy.
What does that do to a property when you want to resell?
Oh, well, I think you're going to have some issues.
Yeah, you'll have some issues.
Yeah.
They'll be the ones that won't grow in value.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's always going to be good and bad performers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And typically the properties in Australia anyway, those properties that are right in the CBD don't really have much growth.
Yeah.
There's a high rent yield, but if you look at Sydney, you look at Melbourne, if it's right in the CBD, there's not a lot of change in value in that.
Yeah, we've done a lot of analysis on people who have bought properties in those types of areas, and they've struggled to do even half of what inflation has been over a 20-year
and
period of time.
And in some instances, they're even a little bit behind where they were when they bought.
Will that change, though, over time? I mean, Europe really uses apartments to live in a city, and I mean, that's just – they've got high density, and people want to live there because of the convenience. Do you think over time Australia will go that way?
But you look at the type of apartments that were constructed in Europe, and there's been a few articles on this recently about – the quality of apartments that were built in Australia 100 years ago, and an Art Deco apartment that was built in the 30s or 40s, that's a solid building.
Yeah.
That building, the bones of that building are really good and are probably still going to be around for another 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of the apartments, Brett, you've mentioned this
absolutely,
in the podcasts before as well.
Cheap construction methods.
Yeah, that's right.
Cheap materials.
Apartment blocks that were built through the 60s, 70s and 80s, probably only have a lifespan of 40 to 60 years.
So why does an investor want to get into something like that when, I mean, we've got this supply of them? Why are people still buying them?
Great question in hindsight, Steph. Now that we know that, well, we've got a bit more data. And in a lot of cases, from a value point of view and from an investment point of view, it doesn't stack up.
Yeah.
But then with what is being built now, if there is a good developer with a good architect, well, maybe you do actually have a project that in itself is going to be worthwhile. Because there are still some apartment buildings that are worthwhile.
Absolutely.
And I think of just two or three of them down the St. Kilda Road corridor that are beautiful apartments that have been around a bit longer than others, and they don't look like boxes. They look like well-designed, solid buildings, with a bit of thought and a bit of niceness about them.
Yeah, so they will date well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of the smaller, let's call them inferior types of apartments that people are buying, Steph, are more than likely being bought because they're weighing up the rent versus own. They're maybe not looking at it as investment or going, we've got to live somewhere. Do I buy or do I rent? And I can afford to buy this. And then it's mine and it's a home.
My other worry for those people that sort of buy into these apartment blocks, and I mean, we've certainly thought about buying an apartment in the CBD as well, just for convenience factor, but a lot of them have been putting in these rooftop gardens and facilities that, you know, sound amazing on paper and would be great to go and use them, but, you know, big pools and things like that. What happens to those kinds of things when there's a breakdown or they need to be serviced or, you know, down the track, you're stuck with all these amenities that are going to need a hell of a lot of updating and your body corporate's going to have to pay for that.
Correct.
And as more people do start investing in apartments just for a cheaper option, they're going to be stuck with that kind of long-term payout.
And that's why anyone we recommend buying in a an apartment that is part of an owner's corporation and does have amenity has a really good look at whether there's a sinking fund, what the owner's corp, rates are and how the budget is, because that can be a big liability if you don't understand it.
Yeah, have a look at the yearly owner's corp fees on that building, because that'll have those things factored in for maintenance of those. And the biggest items are, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, I think one of the biggest additional expenses, apart from the PI insurance that they all have, or the building insurance they all have to carry, the biggest expense is lifts.
Yeah.
Yep.
So as soon as you've got a lift in a building, which every building does, that's one of the biggest things that needs maintenance.
And in some of the bigger buildings, they might have 3 and 4 lifts.
Yep. I've seen well more than that
as
well.
Yeah, depending on how
incredible.
Big.
And then the next piece of expense is a swimming pool. If there's a pool, it needs a lot of upkeep.
Yeah,
if it's got a gym, not so much.
Not so much.
A rooftop garden, maybe that's got a bit, but not so much.
No. I haven't ever done this, but have any of you guys ever sort of compared what a, I don't know, call it a 600 square meter block with a pool at the back, what the maintenance would that on that would be for, you know, gardening, pool upkeep, just general maintenance on a house versus what it would cost for a body corporate.
Be an interesting exercise to run.
Fees.
Yeah.
You know, because remember, owning a house, it doesn't have a body corporate attached to it, but it still has its ongoing maintenance expenses.
Well, I've got two family members that have pools at their homes, and they self-manage. Like, they don't have a pool guy come around or a gardener. But if you did have to cost all of that work, it'd be an interesting exercise to do.
Yeah.
I have to ask my dad, because he's got a pool in his backyard as well, and I know it becomes a real pain to go out there and clean it when it's cold weather.
Absolutely.
And, you know, especially in Melbourne, I mean, you get not that many hot days to even enjoy the damn thing. So.
Well, I sort of did a little bit of analysis. Obviously, we do development ourselves as well, and we look at types of amenities you might put into apartments if we're building those. And one of the issues is at what point do amenity make sense for the size of the development you're doing? Like, if you're doing a 4 or a 10, maybe even up to 20 apartment or townhouse sort of dwelling, amenity's probably not really required, and it's hard to justify and amortize across those amount of dwellings.
Yeah.
So you really only see the type of amenity you're referring to, where there's lavish gyms and big pools and gardens and even dining areas. Typically, you don't see them when there's less than probably 40 dwellings in a development. And that therefore the cost gets, you know, spread equally and therefore it becomes more affordable. But even then, it's still quite a lot. We're seeing owner's corp fees in some buildings be as high as $30,000-$40,000 a year.
Wow.
Yeah.
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 For some of the really upmarket. You know, in East Melbourne, there was something new built there. And I think one of the apartments there, the owner's corp was $40,000 per annum. So not only do you have to be able to afford the property and then your lifestyle, you've got to have $40,000 a year that just goes, that you must pay.
About what you're investing in.
Absolutely. So that's where, you know, from an investment, if we're going to look at investment for financial return and think about apartments, the villa units and the you know, the 2 and 3 story older flats are probably going to make more sense, because there's much lower maintenance. And down the track, when you look at someone buying or renting, they're going to say, okay, well, 2 bedroom in this versus 2 bedroom in the high rise is a comparable price. So you're probably going to get the same yield, yet your outgoings will be a lot less.
Interesting stuff. Look, we might just go to a quick break and we'll come back and just talk more about property in a moment.
Are you concerned about your finances? Maybe you're not sure if you'll have enough money to retire on. Or maybe you've received a redundancy, inheritance, or even a significant promotion, or perhaps a life-changing medical diagnosis. Regardless of your concern or financial position, United Global Capital's advisors are experts in the areas of strategic financial planning, taxation, superannuation and self-managed superannuation funds, risk management, estate planning, and investments. Don't let fate dictate your financial future. Take control today and contact United Global Capital for a no-cost, no-obligation financial strategy consultation. Simply call 03-8657-7640 or email info@ugc.net.au and book your appointment today.
All right, welcome back to our listeners. Now, we're just going to take some closing remarks on this last topic. Joel, you had a few things to say about it.
Yeah, well, look, I'm reminded of a period back in 2012, I think it was, where a famous hedge fund manager out of the United States said he was being interviewed on a CNBC or Bloomberg, and he was asked, so we've got a low interest rate environment, we've got stimulus, quantitative easing, greater access to credit. What do you think is going to happen? And at this period of time, the global economy was still in a pretty shaky sort of period coming out of the global financial crisis. And he said to the interviewer, he said, you know what's going to go up? Everything's going to go up.
Yeah.
And that's what we're seeing. So, we're seeing real estate prices in Melbourne and Sydney improve, and we're even starting to see some improvement across most other markets around Australia. But this is not an isolated thing that's going on here in Australia. We've had interest rates being cut in Australia, three interest rate cuts. We've had greater access to credit being made available in recent months. And the same thing is happening in Europe, same thing's happening in the United States. And you're seeing the same response all around the world. You're seeing Europe, Asia, Australian real estate, American real estate, and stock prices all around the world right now, all starting to increase and show real signs of strength. And so this is what happens in a relatively easy liquidity, easy credit environment. You start to see asset prices increase. And anyone who's been listening to this podcast for a while would know that I've been a major bull in regards to how I see the stock market performing. But those same factors feed into the real estate market and vice versa. So while those conditions remain in place, it's hard to get too negative on the medium term prospects for both shares and real estate right now, because there's just too much easy money floating around and sloshing around, and we don't have an obvious catalyst to prick that enthusiasm right now. Maybe there's the coronavirus, which we might touch on later on, but at this point in time, you have no other option than to be invested right now, whether it's in shares or real estate.
Mm.
All right. Good point. Well, look, we might stick on the property topic now, and I'm going to throw over to Louis, because you're going to have a bit of a chat to us about the new first homeowners guarantee.
Yeah, I am. And I think this plays into the demographics and comes back to one of your comments, Steph, which was about the demand for people's dream houses. Mm. And when you look at the demographics, just a quick summary. So everyone knows the baby boomer generation, people born from 1945 to about 1960. And there's a lump of people who were born in that period of time after the Second World War. The number of people born from 1960 to 1980, the Gen X generation, there are less people in that demographic than baby boomers.
Mm.
Then comes Gen Y. There are more people in Gen Y, let's call it from 1980 to 2000, more people born in that generation than Gen X, and more of them than baby boomers as well, by a little bit. So when you look at these demographics, that lump of population born between 1980 and 2000, those people are now aged between 19 and 39.
Yep.
And I want to focus on the early side of that, because once people reach the age of 30 or 35, they're now maybe 10 to 15 years into their career. They're getting pay rises, earning good money. These days, compared to Gen X or baby boomers, they're much more likely to be a two-income household.
Mm-hmm.
And they are now looking for their dream home. Interest rates are low, big incomes, and the ability to service big mortgages. So when you look at house prices, and particularly the dream house that you're talking about, it's not just about the total population of Australia, because the total population of Australia, Brett's talked about how it grows, and it grows from immigration and also from babies being born minus the number of people dying. Look at the demographics. So it's not just overall population growth that we've got. The growth of the number of people looking to buy homes and good quality homes,
increased, yeah.
That's grown by even more than just the general population rate. Yeah. So there's this huge number of people that are cashed up that are looking to buy their dream home. And I think that's why there is such a shortage of those dream homes. And the price of those really good quality properties is really being bid up.
You got more and more money chasing fewer and fewer stock.
Yeah,
that's right.
The demand outstrips the supply.
Exactly. And let me add something.
And that's only getting started.
That's only getting started, yeah. Exactly. Because half of Generation Y is only under
30. Early 20s, yeah.
Yeah. So they don't have that income earning potential yet, and they don't have a reason or a desire to buy that dream home yet, because if you're under the age of 30, you probably haven't started having kids yet.
Yep.
For the most part.
May still be single.
You might even still be single, likely to be single.
Yep.
You're likely to not have children. So in the next 10 years, that's only going to be even higher.
Exacerbated, yeah.
That's right. The only relief to that is that the baby boomer generation is going to start dying off and releasing some of that property that they own. But that's not going to happen in the next 10 years because baby boomers are now reaching the age of 75. So their rate of death will increase, but most of them are going to live to 85.
Possibly even beyond that.
And likely beyond that.
Yeah.
Their life expectancy is still around that 10-plus years. So it's going to there's going to be this period of time where there's more and more people looking to buy that dream house, and that supply still won't be there.
Do you think, though, that people – I mean, I certainly know from my perspective, I look at it and think, well, I'm not going to pay any more for a decent property now. I mean, I think it's way too high.
Yep.
And, you know, I'd be at the right age to be looking to invest in a dream property.
Mm.
But I'm thinking, no way, I would rather keep my money in the stock market or even
as an investor in
Yeah, because I just think it's ridiculous. And are there going to be other people that think the same way as me? And will it slow?
There's going to be people that think in all kinds of different ways. So, yes, there will be people that think like you. There will be people who say just no to home ownership and let's be invested in real estate. There'll be other people who say no to home ownership and they just blow all their money.
Yeah, yeah.
I know 40-year-olds that are still traveling the world and or 45-year-olds and they've got no savings. There's going to be people who embrace apartment ownership.
Yeah.
And happy to raise a family.
I was going to say, in a larger than normal
two bedroom, two bathroom apartment.
Yeah.
I think there'll be a big chunk of the population that will just be lifelong renters.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like in Europe.
Yep.
Yep.
There'll be a chunk of the population that just cops it and buys it.
Mm.
There'll be a chunk of the population that moves to far away suburbs on the outskirts.
Or regional areas.
Regional areas.
And this is one of the issues for town planners and what they've been trying to address for a long time is how do we create jobs that are not in the CBD? How do we create more regional centres? And lots of investment has gone into those areas that are not even on the fringe of cities but a fair bit out.
Yeah, like at Geelong.
At Geelong.
Ballarat, Bendigo.
But even look at new suburbs like Melton.
Yep.
They just took this tiny little place and they basically said, oh, there's a bit of a community here already. There's heaps of land around it. Oh, and they've also got a racetrack there. Let's just go boom. Let's release all this land.
Yeah.
Let's zone a bunch of it commercial and industrial. Let's zone all these other bits residential. And suddenly let's create a community of 40,000 people with houses to live and jobs to go to.
Yeah.
Well, if you've travelled around other parts of the world, Asia is a bit different because it's very densely populated, but Europe and America are probably more similar to Australia's way of life. In Europe and even in America, a lot of the times between two capital cities, there's no gap. There's just the metropolis that just tends to get to the outer suburbs and then it blends into the outer suburbs of the next one.
Yeah.
And if you look at Melbourne, the gap between where Melbourne's metropolitan area sort of has extended out to Wyndham Vale now and where you're talking about Melton, there's still an expanse of land. But over time, there'll probably be houses dotted the whole way. Maybe not in our lifetime, but over time, that'll happen. Packham's, if the population's...
Packham's gone that way.
Packham's another one. Yep. If you look out east, it's creeping that way. It's...
Yeah,
exactly. It's going to get all the way to Warragul.
Yeah.
Because there's lots of little dots on the way to Warragul that are expanding
bigger. We just don't have the same volume of bigger cities that Europe and America do.
Yeah, if you look and just coming back to your point, Louis, on this demographic trend that you're seeing, households actually spend their most money through family creation years. Mm. And that generally happens when the children – and the peak is generally around the early 40s. And that's when children are starting to go into private high schools or high school and, you know, instead of being able to dress them up in, you know, clothes that they wouldn't ordinarily even know what they're wearing, they start to look for trends. And so, parents have to, you know, go and spend more on trendier clothes and all those types of things to keep them, you know,
yep,
well-suited to their social environment.
And then school fees kick in.
Yeah, all of that stuff and sports and all of that stuff starts to get more expensive around the time that you end up having teenagers. But the millennials or the Gen Ys, they haven't got teenage kids. So the biggest spending power to come into this into our economy is still yet ahead of us, which you know, which bodes well for at least providing some form of support over the next decade or two decades or so.
Do you think our generation though is much bigger spenders? Aren't we buying smashed avocado and spending our money on other things? Like, do people save the same way as what they used to, or are we spending on? I mean, there's a lot of talk around spending on experiences. Yeah.
Yes and no. The older generation puts a lot of commentary towards it because they're the ones who are the journalists who get to write the newspaper articles.
But I've seen a lot of older generation that have been poor savers themselves.
Yeah.
All the older generation did, the biggest thing they did was just pay off their mortgage.
And
the reason why they're critical of the next generation is because we do it differently. Some of us do it badly, but so did some of them.
But I'm not going to say the vast majority of our Gen Y clients are very focused on savings and getting ahead and, you know, putting together investment portfolios and buying real estate portfolios. So, we're doing it differently. Most of them are most of those clients are still renting. So, they're not buying their dream homes. They're renting and they are investing their money elsewhere. A lot of them are becoming rentvestors and, you know, renters and investors in the share market.
Yep. Because they're probably more tuned into what they want their lifestyle to be than what the previous generations were more worried about home ownership being the biggest issue.
Yeah. So, look, the piece of news and what's happened from the 1st of January to even fuel this generation even more is what's happened with first home buyers and the government supports. So, if you think of what has been in place in the past, there used to be the first home buyers bonus from the federal government and they would just give $7,000 cash if you're a first home buyer. State governments pretty much all have some kind of stamp duty concession where stamp duty might be halved for a first home buyer. Some of those schemes are limited in terms of whether you're buying a property under or over a certain purchase price.
And new versus old it sometimes comes into it.
Yeah, and if it's a brand new property, well, then there's an extra $7,000, so a $14,000 bonus from the government, from the federal government. If it's regional, then it's $14,000. So different forms over different pieces of points of time. And the latest one to come out now is the First Home Loan Deposit Scheme. And this is a bit different to just giving out $7,000 in cash, which is what you'd expect.
Yep.
But if a first home buyer has an initial deposit of 5% or 10%, or even anything that's less than 20% plus costs, that first home buyer is going to have to pay lender's mortgage insurance on their home loan.
Mm-hmm.
And what is lender's mortgage insurance? So, let's do it by way of an example. Mm. It's the easiest way to explain. If I have, let's say I have a 10% deposit towards my property, I get a home loan and the bank says, yes, we'll give you the loan, but we are worried that if you can't pay the loan, if you default and we have to sell your loan, then what happens if the value of your loan is not enough, is more than the value of your property at the time of sale?
Yeah. So, we're talking when they're lending, say, that 90%. You said 10% deposit, so the balance is all coming from a lender.
That's correct, yeah. So, 90% of the value of the property is a loan.
Mm.
What happens if property falls by 10% and you default? Well, then we might be out of pocket by however much it falls beyond that 10%. So, you have to pay this thing called lender's mortgage insurance. And it's an absolute rort, by by the banks, as far as I'm concerned, and the insurance companies, because it doesn't protect you. If there's a difference, so if you're out of pocket by $20,000 or $50,000, you still owe that to the bank.
Yep.
But the bank is covered by the insurer, so the bank gets their money from them, and then they can get the money from you as well.
I've got a question, because, Joel, I mean, you're saying it's negative, Louis. I've heard you, Joel, speak about it as an okay.
Yeah, so in certain circumstances and in certain market conditions, if you take the view that real estate is likely to increase quite substantially over the medium term, and let's say you are short from having enough of a deposit to put down to avoid lender's mortgage insurance. So typically, if you've got a 20% deposit, which would mean a loan-to-value ratio of 80%, then the bank, and so long as you can cover stamp duty on top of that, then the bank will typically not enforce lender's mortgage insurance on you. But if the LVR is less than 80%, then they will. And in certain
higher than 80%, sorry.
Higher than 80%, yeah. Then they will. So in that instance, if you are, say, sitting at a 10% deposit, but you think that the value of your property could increase quite substantially, and there's an opportunity cost.
It might grow by 10% in the next year, maybe compounding over 2 years.
Correct. So, yep. There's an opportunity cost of not getting into that property, yep, today. Then there can be an advantage in actually incurring that lender's mortgage insurance in order to seek a higher benefit over the next few years through increased price appreciation. The other thing is also that lender's mortgage insurance for investment properties is actually claimable over a five-year period, yeah, of time. So, you can claim that as a deduction in your tax return and amortize that over a five-year period. So, it's not fully assessable, but it is partially going to be offset by tax benefits.
Yeah. I'd actually say usually it's beneficial to go ahead with the purchase because you build it into the purchase price, and you're exactly right, Joel. If lender's mortgage insurance costs $10,000 as an initial cost, well, what's your alternative? Your alternative is to not buy the property at all and keep saving until you've got 20%, but that means your purchase might be 5 years away.
Yeah.
And what's going to happen to property prices over 5 years?
So it can be a necessary evil, but the banks are.
Well, 99% of the time, it is a necessary evil. Yeah. So I don't like it, but the reality is it's there.
Yeah.
And it's there because it's just part of the system. So I'm not saying don't do lender's mortgage insurance, but I am saying
lucky banks.
It's, yeah, lucky banks. Good on them.
Yeah, it's only for their protection.
Yeah, that's right.
So I think this is pretty clever from the government. What they've said is if you're getting your first home loan and you've got a 5% deposit, we will guarantee your loan as the government, which means you don't have to pay lender's mortgage insurance.
I like it.
Right. There's obviously certain conditions around that in terms of the value of the property and everything.
Yes, there's a number of conditions. So the first thing is they've released 10,000 places available from the 1st of January to the 30th of June this year. So it's open to 10,000 people. 3,000 in the first month. The way it's claimed is just by taking out a normal home loan application with one of the lenders who is approved under the scheme. It's actually not all big four banks approved under the scheme. I know that Commonwealth Bank is approved and NAB is approved as of today, but second and third tier lenders.
Do you have to go and ask them? I mean, how does this sort of all happen as well? Like what?
Or every bank mortgage application already has a tick box.
Okay.
Are you a first homeowner? Concessions and other first homeowner grants.
I've got another question on first homeowners. I have never owned a property, but Joel has. Does that still apply?
Depends on the scheme.
Right.
Some schemes say yes, some schemes say no.
Okay.
So what
and who's buying? Are you buying on your own or are you buying with Joel?
So this particular scheme, if you are a single person and your income is over $125,000 a year, then you're not eligible. If you're a couple and your income's over $200,000, then you're not eligible. If your purchase price is more than a certain amount, then again, you're not eligible.
And that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
There needs to be thresholds.
And the smart thing is they've actually broken up Australia into 21 different regions. And they have a different price threshold for Sydney, New South Wales regional centres, and New South Wales non-regional centres. Victoria's capital city has a different threshold to New South Wales. So in Sydney, there's a price cap of 700,000. In Melbourne, it's 600,000. In Brisbane, it's 475,000. In Perth, it's 400,000. Tasmania's 400,000. Hobart is 400,000. And regions is a lower cutoff because you can still get a pretty nice place in regional Victoria. So under 375,000 in regional Victoria compared to 600,000 in Melbourne. So if your property's in that category and you're a first homeowner that meets the income criteria, well, then you can get this. Mm-hmm. The other thing I like about the government is it's a bit of arbitrage because lender's mortgage insurance might cost the purchaser $10,000 or $20,000. If it's a 5% deposit, it might be a $20,000 or $25,000 charge with lender's mortgage insurance. For the government, it actually doesn't cost them anything to provide a guarantee.
Yeah. Not at all.
There's no money on the table.
Yep.
The only time the government would need to chip in is if it's called upon, which is if the home buyer goes into default and the bank sells the property for less than the value of the loan.
Which is the risk of that's quite minimal, really.
Absolutely minimal, which is why I said it's rot in the first place.
It is, yeah.
And is why I think it's really smart by the government to cut the legs out of that.
Yeah,
I'm wondering how many brokers are really going to become proficient at this too, because this is a space. If I'm a first homeowner and I'm trying to get a loan, and obviously Louis, there's the panel of lenders there.
Yep.
Good brokers should be fully across this to help their purchases.
But absolutely. What are you saying? Like long term, you're just saying that there's only a specific amount of spots at this stage. How long will this extend for?
I don't know how long it's going to extend for, but what they have said is that there's 10,000 places available in the next 6 months, and then from 1st of July, they'll release another 10,000 places.
Yep. Like what they did with NRAS, they did a similar thing, 10,000 a year.
Yeah. And the difference with NRAS is it was a commitment to 10 years for the government.
Yeah.
So
Well, and that was for investors, not owner-occupiers.
And different investors, scheme. Yeah.
But I just remember the licensing came about 10,000.
Yeah, that's right. So they'll test it and they'll see how it works.
Yeah.
And they'll see what the impact is.
Good thing to think about if you are a first owner and meet those the criteria.
So what that means as far as those demographics, not only will this Gen Y population, not only will they be trying to get their dream houses, but it also stimulates them to look at the lower end of the market as well.
Yep.
So that end of the market will probably go into some kind of shortage as a result of this as well.
Mm.
Yeah. Hey, we're all screwed.
No, we just all need to navigate our way through all this.
Yeah. That's right. You just need to do the best.
The opportunities are there.
Just means you just got to do the best with what you've got.
Yeah.
That's true. But there's competition.
Yeah, which is healthy.
Absolutely it is. Yeah.
Well, look, we might go to another quick break and we'll be back after this message.
Want to learn the strategies that have achieved returns more than double the return of the average superannuation fund? Each day, clients of United Global Capital are using strategies and tactics that were once thought the domain of the professional investor or the super rich. Book your seat at UGC's Financial Fast Track Seminars, where you'll learn the science behind selecting high-performance stocks and real estate, how you can participate in advanced strategies like property development, short selling, and international investments, as well as how to protect your wealth against major adverse market events. To secure your seat, simply go to ugc.net.au/events and select the seminar that suits your needs. Seats are limited, so book your spot now.
Okay, welcome back, guys. We're now going to throw it over to Joel. And Joel, you've just got a little bit of an update on the market.
Yeah, so look, a week is a long time in the stock market and a fortnight is even longer. Fancy that.
That's how time works. Always curious about that.
He's back.
Oh, yeah. We missed you last week. Yeah. Good to see you again.
So we have seen, and as I mentioned earlier in this podcast, with credit becoming easier, with getting easier to come across and cost of financing being lowered, stock markets around the world are doing very, very well in line with real estate markets. Now, they're getting to the point now where perhaps for the last 3 months, particularly overseas in the US, but even here in Australia, we've had quite a run in just the last couple of weeks. We're getting to the point where sentiment is now at extreme levels of optimism. So, while we remain quite bullish around the medium to longer term prospects for the stock markets globally, particularly here in Australia and the United States over the next 6 to 12 months. We are probably likely to face some form of a correction sometime in the next, I would say, 4 to 6 weeks. Whether or not that correction is going to be a 2% or a 3% or a 5 to 8%, I'm not too sure. There is still a significant underlying bid under this market at the moment. So I expect any correction to be quite contained and not too brutal. But there is the prospect that as we get into later this month and early into February, the market is susceptible for whatever reason. It is always tends to be a little bit susceptible to a bit of a correction around this time of the year. And we've got the perfect set of bullish sentiment conditions to allow that to take place. Now, what is the trigger for that correction? I don't know, but certainly a lot of news just recently has come out around the coronavirus in China, in the Wuhan, in the city of Wuhan. Now, last time the Chinese had a scare such as the SARS virus, which was back in 2003, it created a level of panic in China to the point that it impacted their GDP by around about 1%. So, If that type of outbreak took place here in Australia, and we had a 1% dip in our GDP, with our economic conditions right now, we would probably be in recession. Now the Chinese are running their GDP growth at currently around about 6%. So if this does start to unfold, and it starts to put a real scare at a really, you know, poor time for the Chinese, and because right now we've got Chinese New Year, which is that today or to start? Is that tomorrow?
Yeah, Saturday, yeah.
Saturday, yeah. So Chinese New Year, the world's largest mass migration of people traveling around to get home and spend time with their family. If the concerns around this coronavirus start to spread and this disease gets more out of control than perhaps where it is today, it could be just the trigger to kick off a small little mini correction. Yeah. But if we do get that, don't panic. It'll usually go and probably be somewhere around about a 4 to 6 week and 5 to 8% garden variety correction, and this could be the ideal set of conditions to lead to the next rally, and that could be even stronger than what we've seen over the last 3 months.
And now I have to change my summer beer of choice. No more Corona.
No more Corona.
Drink a different one now.
Do you remember or you might not remember, there used to be, in fact, I think there still is, a brand of soft drink, the sarsaparilla soft drink, which is on the can, SARS.
Yeah.
Yeah, sorry about that.
SARS, yeah. SARS virus.
Absolutely. Joel.
Bad timing.
Joel, what do you do from a portfolio management point of view? You see a correction's coming. What do you do in the portfolio in that time? Because a lot of people would be commenting to you now, well, if you can see that there's a correction on the horizon, can't you just pull our portfolio out and then buy back in when
I get that question? I get that question a lot when I start to flag that a correction is on the on the horizon. And look, in terms of the way that we approach corrections, we don't move money out of the market. Instead, what we do is we go into hyperdrive trying to find those stocks that are holding up in the correction. Those that are resisting the correction and looking for relative strength. We're looking to rotate our portfolios into those stocks that aren't selling off anywhere near to the level that the stock market is selling off. So you just never know whether or not it's going to be a 2% correction, a 5% correction, or an 8% correction. If it's anything less than 5%, you know, it's not tradable really for a portfolio investor. It comes and it goes, and it could be over in a matter of days, or it could last for a few weeks. But, you know, a lot of the time, you know, you don't know by the time you see the correction and the time you start to take action. The correction is probably already at its worst. And then by the time you're moving out, the market's probably already starting to recover. So instead, what we rather do is we look at our portfolios and we wash them like a hawk, and we look for those stocks that start breaking down in our portfolios, and we're screening the markets like hell, looking for those stocks that are holding up, and we're allocating to to strength, and we'll make changes to our individual stock holdings based on where we see that relative strength. Because usually, what happens is that the ones that are holding up the best are the ones that launch out of the correction and give you the great level of outperformance and alpha.
Right. It's a bit like if a cyclone's coming, you go to the stronger buildings.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah,
the ones that'll stand up and last.
So it's almost impossible to make money when the stock market falls because you can't pick the timing or the duration, but you do try to make money from the stock market bouncing back, recovering from the low.
That's right.
So that's the strategy.
So you've got to put it into context, right? So right now we're in a long term, medium term, and even a short term uptrend, both on the Australian stock market and the US stock market. Now, what I suspect is going to happen is we're going to get a short term correction, but the medium and long term trends should still remain in place. So in that environment, it's almost impossible to try and counter trend trade this market. Instead, you're looking for benefiting from when the recovery comes and making sure you're exposing your portfolio to those stocks that are likely to rocket out of that correction.
Okay, great.
Well, we'll be watching that pretty close, and no doubt we'll have another update on a further podcast in the future.
Well, we'll be back next week.
Yeah, that's right. Hopefully it doesn't hit by then. Yeah. We might just close now with our favourite topic of the day. It's You Can't Be Serious. Has won this morning?
Well, as we enter into this segment, I just want to give a shout out to the inspiration for it, Supermac, with the row. I saw the other day, love him or hate him, Nick Kyrgios. I've been a fan for a long time, and he's sort of been the leader of the bushfire sort of funding, the relief funding. I saw Supermac the other day say that for as long as Nick Kyrgios is in the tournament, he's going to contribute $1,000 to bushfire relief for every set he wins. They're all jumping on board.
Well done.
Always nice to have his commentary on the Australian Open. Absolutely. We're all familiar with the occasional breakout on the Twitter news of someone's death that isn't actually happening.
Fake news.
And we always get the famous quote of, reports of my death have been greatly exaggerated. quote comes back time to time. But we've had this happen in an old school way. This is how it used to happen. A man has found his own grave in a cemetery.
His own.
His own grave.
Didn't crawl out of it.
His own name on a headstone with his own date of birth.
Wow.
Despite him being very much alive.
Identity theft.
Wow.
That's right. And his top suspect is he blames his ex-wife. He wants to know the truth. He blames his ex-wife, but in his words, I'm still alive, but I can't quite be sure it was her. And I have to put on a derogatory voice for this. I don't even want to be buried. I want to be cremated.
I can see a tombstone with your name on it, Joel Hewish.
Yes. Well,
the question for me is which ex-wife will put it there.
There's only one.
This one was hard enough. I love you, darling. Love you.
Yeah, love you too.
Switzerland has minted a gold coin so small you'd need to look very closely to see it. I don't know if you've ever seen this.
And I know what's on it.
Yeah. So, this gold coin is just 2.96 millimeters in width, which is 0.12 inches. So it's the smallest gold coin in the world. Weighs just, 0.063 grams, so 1/500th of an ounce. And if you look closely enough, you'll see Albert Einstein sticking his tongue out at you.
You'll need pretty strong eyes to see that.
Oh my goodness.
Well, before we go, I want to pay tribute to some of our friends across the ditch. New Zealand come up with some good ones every now and then. Abalone, a great food.
Yes.
Oh, wonderful.
New Zealanders call it by a different name. I don't know if any of you know it.
Don't.
It's called, it's actually written P-A-U-A and pronounced power, sort of power.
Yep.
Someone in New Zealand decided, the New Zealand Fisheries Office needs a name change. They put forward to Parliament that it be changed to the Power Rangers.
Love that.
Nice.
Yes, do it.
All right. Well, look, we're going to have to actually wrap it up there because we're a little bit over time, but have a fabulous long weekend to our listeners and to you guys as well, and we'll do it all again next week.
Looking forward to it. Thanks, Steph.
Thank you.
See ya.